Nor was there ever any sign that my mother had married for love. She was an old maid, and I would guess far too peculiar to gather other suitors. Her behavior, as I witnessed it, was apt to be excessive and ungovernable, with manic tours from pinnacles of rosy hilarity to hours of brooding looks. Sometimes she became frantic. She was forever running to ransack her crowded dresser drawers, rummaging in her sewing box as she made high-pitched, excited noises. Because she seldom left home, her sisters made it a habit to look after her. This was a brave endeavor. When my aunts visited, my father would assail them in loud conversation with himself as busybodies, and he was not above actual threats of violence if they came when he was drunk. The two who ventured most often, my aunts Flo and Sarah, were both bold, determined women, their father's daughters, and they were apt to control my father with stern looks and fearless demeanor, not much different than if they were confronting some barking cur. They were undeterred in their unannounced mission to protect the meek, Rosie, my mother, and, especially, me. For me, these sisters were a hovering presence throughout my childhood. They brought me candies. They took me for haircuts and bought my clothes. They supervised my upbringing in such routine fashion that I was in my 20s before I recognized their intentions, or their kindness. And somehow, without ever realizing it had happened, I grew to know there were two worlds, my mother's and the other one, dwelled in by her sisters, the one to which I eventually recognized I, as well, belonged. It was a fixed star of my youth to think that my mother was not, as I put it to myself, regular. To know that my adoration of her was a purely private matter, unintelligible to others, and beyond my power to explain. Do I really care what she would think now? I suppose. What child would not? I'm almost glad she did not live to witness this. In her last few months, she was with us. We were still living in the city in a one-bedroom apartment, but Barbara refused to see my mother anywhere else. She slept on a daybed in the living room, from which she seldom rose. Barbara, most of the time, sat on a hard wooden chair drawn close. Near the end, my mother spoke constantly to Barbara. Her head was laid on her pillow, her face sadly reduced by disease, her eyes narrowly focused, their light growing weak. Barbara held her hand. They murmured. I could not make out the words, but the sound was constant, like a running tap. Barbara Bernstein, daughter of a sleek suburban matron, and my mother, of roaming mind and indelibly sweet disposition, voyaged to one another, crossed the straits of loneliness, while I, as ever, was too full of private grief to make my own approach. I watched them from the door, for Barbara, the mother who made no demands, for Rosie, the child who would not disregard her. When I took Barbara's place, my mother held my hand. I had the decency to tell her often that I loved her. She smiled weakly, but seldom spoke. Near the end, it was Barbara who gave her the shots of Demerol. A few of the syringes are still downstairs in a box of odd keepsakes of my mother that Barbara maintains. Antique bobbins and index cards, the gold-tipped Parker pen she used to make notes for her radio appearances. I walked through the dark to find my slippers, slide my robe from the closet. In the living room, I sit, feet up, huddled in a rocking chair. Lately, I have been thinking of taking up cigarettes again. I feel no cravings, but it would give me something to do in these abject hours in the dead of night when I am now so often awake. A game I play with myself is called What is the Worst Part? So many things seem trivial. I do not care much now about the way the women gape at me when I walk around in the village center. I do not worry about my reputation or the fact that for the rest of my life, even if charges are dropped tomorrow, many people will cringe reflexively whenever they hear my name. I do not worry about how hard it will be for me to find work as an attorney if I am acquitted. But the steady emotional erosion, the sleeplessness, the manic anxiety I cannot pretend about or minimize. What is worse are these midnight wakings and the instants before I can gather myself, when I am sure that the terror is never going to end. It is like groping for the switch plate in the dark, but I am never certain. And here the terror is the worst. I am never sure that I will find it. As the search becomes more and more prolonged, a little bit of sense that holds forth in me erodes, gives way, bubbles off like a tablet dropped into water, and the wild blackness of some limitless and everlasting panic begins to swallow me. That is what is worst. That and my worries about Nathaniel. On Sunday we will put him on a train for Camp Okawaka near Skagen, where he is scheduled to remain for the 3 weeks the trial is projected to last. Recalling this, I quietly tread the stairs and stand in the dark hall outside his door. I listen until I can catch the rhythm of his breath, and then force my own breathing down to that same measure. As I watch Nat sleep, the weirdness of science overcomes me. I think of atoms and molecules, skin and veins, muscle and bones. I try to comprehend my son for an instant as a compilation of parts, but that fails. We cannot ever enlarge the realm of our final understanding. I know Nathaniel as the hot mass of my feelings for him. I behold him as something no smaller or more finite or reducible than my passions. He will not piece or parse. He is my boy, gentle and beautiful in sleep. And I am grateful, grateful so that my heart is sore and breaking, that in this rough life I have felt such tenderness. If I am convicted, they will take me away from him. Even Laren Little will send me to prison for many years, and the thought of missing the remainder of his young life shatters me, breaks me into pieces. Oddly, I feel little conscious fear of prison itself. I dread the exile and the separation. The thought of confinement can make me ill at ease, but the actual physical horrors I am sure to suffer are seldom in my mind, even when I pierce myself with the thought of the extreme consequences I may face. And yet I know. I have spent days at Rudyard, the state pen where every murderer is sent. I have been there usually to interview a witness, but the sights are chilling. The bars are heavy iron slats, painted flat black, 2 inches deep, 1/2 inch wide, and behind them are all these bastards who now it strikes you, are so much the same. The black guys chattering their manic, raging stuff, the white guys in their rolled-up stocking caps, the Latinos who look out with pointy-eyed rage. They are, collectively, every man you have avoided in a hallway or a bus station, every kid you picked out in high school is destined to be a bum. They are the ones who always wore their deficits like scars, headed here almost as certainly as a skyward shot arrow plunging back to earth. About this group, it is no longer possible to harbor any kind of sentiment. I have heard every horror story, and I know that these grisly anecdotes are some of the unseen ink that blackens my dreams. For me, this will not be far from torture. I know about the nighttime shivs, about the showers where blowjobs are given in the open. I know about Marcus Wheatley, one of the guys I tried to get to talk in Night Saints, who hosed somebody on a dope deal down there and was laid on his back in the weight room, told to put up his hands and then given a barbell with 250 pounds on each end, which asphyxiated him, even while it acted half like a guillotine. I know about the demographics of that neighborhood, 16% murderers, and more than half the inmates there for some form of violent crime. I know about the gray food, the 4 men in a cell, the odor of excrement that is overpowering on certain tiers. I know that every month there are areas where the gang control becomes so complete that the guards refuse to walk through for days. I know about the guards themselves, and the 8 of them who were convicted in the federal court for a New Year's party they threw in which they used shotguns to line up 12 black prisoners whom they took turns beating with flagstones and bricks. I know about what happens to men like me there, because I know what happened to some I helped ascend. I know about Marcy Lupino, who, whenever my thoughts loiter here, is the person most likely to come to mind. Marcella was a regular type, your basic hustling American, a CPA who early in his career did a little work setting odds for some of the boys from his old neighborhood. Eventually, Marcy's accounting practice prospered, and he determined that he no longer required outside employment, at which time John Conti, one of the boys, informed him that his was not the kind of job that he was free to quit. And that's the way it went. Marcy Lupino, respected CPA, PTA president, and member of the board of directors of two banks, a guy who wouldn't monkey with the books of his biggest client, left his office every afternoon at 3:30 p.m. sharp to set the spread on ball games to tote the odds for tomorrow's ponies. All well and good until one day when a federal snitch gave away a wire room. The IRS came through the door and found Marcy Lupino, among half a dozen other people, and $3 million in betting slips. The feds wanted him to talk in the worst way, but Marcy was very good at arithmetic. 2 years on a gambling beef, mail fraud, wire fraud, racketeering charges, whatever the feds could put to him, was not worth 10 minutes of what John Conti and the boys would do. They would cut out his testicles and feed them to him, make him chew. And this, Marcy Lupino knew, was not a figure of speech. So Mike Townsend from the Organized Crime Strike Force called me. He wanted to provide Marcy with incentives. We charged Marcy stateside, and when he was convicted, he went to Rudyard instead of the federal overnight camp he had been counting on, a place with a salad bar and tennis courts, a place where he would teach bookkeeping to inmates working on college degrees and copulate with Mrs. Lupino every 90 days as part of the furlough program. Instead, we sent him off in manacles, chained to a man who had put out his infant daughter's eyes with his keys. 6 months later, Townsend called, and we took a trip north to see if Lupino had responded. We found him in a field with a hoe. He was scraping at the ground. We reintroduced ourselves, hardly a necessity. Marcy Lupino took his hoe, propped it under his arm, and leaned on it as he wept. He cried like I've never seen a man cry. He shook from head to toe. His face turned purple, and the water poured from his eyes truly as from a faucet. A little, fat, bald-headed, 48-year-old man, crying as hard as he could. But he would not talk. He said one thing to us. I got no teat. Nothing else. As we were walking back, the guard explained. Big Buck Nigger, Drover, wanted Lupino as his babe. He's the kind, man, nobody says no, not even the Italians in this joint. He gets himself into Lupino's cell one night, takes out his dingus, and tells Lupino to suck. Lupino won't, so Drover takes Lupino's face and bangs it on the bunk rail until there is not a whole tooth left in Lupino's head. Some aching roots, some pieces, but not one tooth. Warden's got a rule, the guard says. You get bandages for your wounds, we'll sew you up, but no special treatment unless you talk. Fucking Lupino ain't getting his false teeth until he tells who did the tap dance on him. Fucking Lupino, he ain't telling, he knows what's good for him. Nobody here is that dumb. No, the guard says, he ain't telling. An old Drover, he is laughing. He says he done a real good job, and that his Big Johnson goes in there now smooth as silk. He says he's been in many pussies that don't feel that good. The guard, a fine humanitarian, leaned on his shotgun and laughed. Crime, he reported to Townsend and me, sure don't pay. Run, I think now as I sit in the dark contemplating Marcy Lupino. Run. The thought always comes that suddenly. Run. As a prosecutor, I could never understand why they stayed around to let it fall, to face trial, sentencing, prison. But they remained, for the most part, as I have. There is $1,600 in my checking account, and I have no other money in the world. If I looted Barbara's trust, I would have enough to go, but then I would probably lose the only real motive I have for freedom, the chance to see Nat. and even if I could spend summers with him in Rio or Uruguay or wherever it is they do not extradite for murder, the powers of even a desperate fancy are too meager to imagine how I would survive without a language I know or a skill those cultures would recognize. I could simply disappear to the center of Cleveland or Detroit, become somebody different, and never see my son again. But the fact is that none of these are visions of what I recognize as life. Even in these lightless hours, I want the same things I wanted when I got off the bus at night in the village green in Nearing. We are so simple sometimes, and fortified so strangely. I sit here in the dark with my heels drawn against me, and as I shiver, I imagine the odor of the smoke of cigarettes. Chapter 26
People versus Rojat K. Savage, calls Ernestine, Judge Little's docket clerk, into the crowded courtroom. She is a stern-looking black woman, 6 feet tall.
For trial, she cries.
Not much is like the first day of a murder trial. Sun up on the morning of battle. Christians against lions back in Rome. Blood is on the air. Spectators have crammed themselves into every linear inch available along the public benches. There are 4 full rows of press, 5 sketch artists at the head. The judge's staff, his secretary and law clerks, who are not ordinarily present, are in folding chairs against the rear wall of the courtroom, next to his chamber's door. Bailiffs, armed for this solemn occasion, are positioned at the forward corners of the bench beside the marble pillars. The atmosphere is busy and intense, full of a racing murmur. No one here is bored. Judge Little enters and the room comes to its feet. Ernestine makes her announcement.
Oyez, oyez, the Superior Court for the County of Kendall is now in session. The Honorable Laron L. Little, Judge presiding. Draw near and give your attention, and you shall be heard. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Ernestine bangs her gavel. When everyone is seated, she calls my case for trial. The lawyers and I move to the podium. Stern and Kemp, Molto and Nico. Glendenning has appeared and will be the case investigator, sitting with the prosecutors. I stand behind the lawyers. Judge Little looms above, his hair newly cut and smoothly groomed. It is August 18th, a few days short of 2 months since I was indicted.
"Are we ready to call for a jury?" Laron asks.
"Judge," says Kemp, "we have a few matters that we can address while you are bringing up the prospective jurors." Kemp's role on this case will be lawman. Stern has put him in charge of research, and Jamie will address the judge with regard to points of law outside the jury's presence. When they are in the box, he will not say a word. From the courtroom phone, Ernestine calls the clerk's reception room and asks for a venire, citizens summoned for jury duty who will be questioned by the judge and lawyers to determine if they should serve in this case.
"Judge," Kemp says again, "we have received all the production you ordered from the prosecution, with one exception. We have still not been given an opportunity to see that glass."
Stern has instructed Jamie to raise this for reasons besides our curiosity about the glass. He wants Judge Little to know that the prosecutors are conforming to the judge's dim expectations. It works. Laron is upset.
"What about this, Mr. Delay Guardia?"
Nico clearly does not know. He looks for Molto.
"Judge," says Tommy, "we'll take care of it after court."
"All right," says Laron. "That will be done today."
"Also," Kemp says, "you have not ruled on our motion to disqualify Mr. Molto."
"That is correct. I have been waiting for the prosecutor's response. Mr. Delay Guardia?"
Tommy and Nico exchange glances and nod to one another. They will proceed according to their prior agreement, whatever that is.
"Your Honor, the state will not call Mr. Molto, so we suggest that the motion is moot."
Stern steps forward and asks to be heard.
"Do I understand, then, Your Honor, that Mr. Molto will not be called under any circumstances?" that his testimony is forsworn throughout the case and at all stages?
That's right, Laren agrees. I'd like us all to be clear at the start, Mr. Delay Guardia. I don't want to be hearing later about you didn't expect this or you didn't expect that. Mr. Molto is not testifying at this trial, correct?
Correct, Nico says.
Very well. I will deny the defendant's motion on the representation of the prosecutors that Mr. Molto will not be called as a witness at this trial.
Ernestine whispers to him. The prospective jurors are in the corridor.
So in they come. 75 people, 12 of whom will soon be in charge of deciding what happens to my life. Nothing special, just folks.
You could skip the summonses and the questionnaires and grab the first 75 people who walked by on the street. Ernestine calls 16 to sit in the jury box and directs the remainder to the first four rows on the prosecution side, from which the bailiffs have dismissed the spectators amid great grumbling, sending them to form a waiting line out in the hall.
Laren starts by telling the Venera what the case is all about. He has probably seen 1,000 juries chosen during his career. His rapport is instantaneous, this big, good-looking black man, kind of funny, kind of smart. The white people take to him, too, thinking probably they all should be like this. Nowhere in a trial is Laren's advantage to the defense likely to be greater than at this juncture. He is skilled in addressing juries, canny in divining hidden motivations, and committed to the foundation of his soul, to the fundamental notions. The defendant is presumed innocent. Innocent. As you sit here, you have got to be thinking, Mr. Savage didn't do it.
I'm sorry, sir, in the first row, what is your name?
Mihailovich.
Mr. Mihailovich, did Mr. Savage commit the crime that he is charged with?
Mihailovich, a stout middle-aged man who has his paper folded in his lap, shrugs.
I wouldn't know, Judge.
Mr. Mihailovich, you are excused.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you again what you are to presume. Mr. Savage is innocent. I am the judge. I am telling you that. Presume he is innocent. When you sit there, I want you to look over and say to yourself, there sits an innocent man.
He goes through similar exercises, expounding upon the state's burden to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and the defendant's right to remain silent. Talking to a thin, gray-haired lady in a shirtwaist dress, who is seated in the chair beside the one Mihailovich once occupied,
now don't you think, ma'am, that an innocent person ought to get up there and tell you it's not so?
The lady is torn. She saw what happened to Mihailovich. But you don't lie to a judge. She touches her dress at the collar before she speaks.
I would think so, she says. Of course you would. And you have to presume that Mr. Savage thinks the same thing, since we're presuming that he's innocent. But he doesn't have to do that, because the Constitution of the United States says he doesn't have to. And what that means is that if you sit as jurors on this case, you have promised to put that thought out of your mind, because Mr. Savage and his lawyer, Mr. Stern, may decide to rely on that constitutional right. The folks who wrote the Constitution said, God bless you, sir, God bless you, Mr. Savage, you don't have to explain. The state's got to prove you guilty. You don't have to say a thing if you don't want. And Mr. Savage can't really receive that blessing if any of you have it in your mind that he should explain anyway.
As a prosecutor, I used to find this part of Laren's routine unbearable. And Nico and Molto both look pale and upset. No matter how many times you tell yourself that the judge is right, you can't believe that anybody ever thought it was going to be explained so emphatically. Nico looks particularly drawn. He listens with an alert, humorless expression. He has lost weight, and there is a new darkening in the sallow skin beneath his eyes. To get a case of this stature prepared in 3 weeks is a terrible burden, and he has an office to run as well. Moreover, it must have occurred to him often how much he has put on the line. He has taken Klieg lights and run them across the sky, telling the near world to watch Nico Della Guardia. If he loses, he will never have the same credibility in office. His silent campaign to be earmarked as Bolcaro's successor will be finished not long after its start. His career, much more than mine, hangs in the balance. I have lately come to realize that my career, after this indictment and the hoopla of this trial, is probably over in any event. Next, Laren takes up the subject of publicity. He questions jurors about what they have read. For those who are being coy, he points out the article announcing the start of the trial on the front page of today's Trib. Jurors always lie about this. People who want to get out of jury service usually find a way. The ones who come to the courthouse are, for the most part, eager to serve and less willing to confess to obvious disqualifications. But Laren slowly wins the truth from them. Nearly everybody here has heard something about this case, and over about 20 minutes Judge Little tells them that is worthless information. "Nobody knows anything about this case," he says, "because there has not been a word of evidence heard." He excuses 6 people who admit they will not be able to put the publicity out of their minds. It is unsettling to consider what the others, subjected to Nico's media splash, must think about the case. It's hard to believe that anyone can really fully put aside those preconceptions. Late in the morning, questioning about the jurors' backgrounds begins. This process is called voir dire, truth-telling, and it continues throughout the afternoon and into the second morning. Laren asks everything he can think of, and the lawyers add more. Judge Little will not allow questioning directed to the issues of the case, but the attorneys are permitted to roam freely into personal details, limited largely only by their own reluctance to give offense. What TV shows do you watch? What newspapers do you read? Do you belong to any organizations? Do your children work outside the home? In your house, are you or your spouse in charge of the monthly bookkeeping? This is the subtle psychological game of figuring out who is predisposed to favor your side. Consultants now earn hundreds of thousands of dollars making such predictions for lawyers, but an attorney like Stern knows most of this by instinct and experience. To pick a jury effectively, you must know the case you want to try. Stern has not said anything to me, but it is becoming clearer that he has a strong notion not to offer evidence for the defense. He thinks he can whittle away at Nico's proof. Perhaps my actions in the past, when I have been beyond control in spite of his instructions, have convinced him I would be a poor witness in my own behalf. No doubt the decision to testify or not will be mine in the end, but I suspect that Stern is simply trying to move things to the point that I am convinced we can win without my testimony, before he forces my hand. In any event, he has spent little time talking to me about the defense case. Mac and a few of the judges have agreed to appear as character witnesses. Stern also has asked me about neighbors who would be willing to offer that kind of testimony. Clearly, though, he wants to try a reasonable doubt case. At the end, if all goes as he hopes, no one will know what happened. The state will have failed to meet its burden of proof, and I should be acquitted. With that goal, we need jurors bright enough to appreciate the legal standard and strong enough to forthrightly apply it, people who will not convict merely because they are suspicious. For that reason, Sandy has told me that he thinks younger jurors will be better overall than old. In addition, they may be more in tune with some of the nuances of male and female relations that so strongly flavor the case. He wants, in other words, people who might believe that co-workers adjourn to a woman's apartment for reasons other than sexual intercourse. On the other hand, he has said, older people will have more immediate respect for my past attainments, my position, and my reputation. Whatever the plans, you usually go in the end on gut impressions. Certain jurors just seem to be people you think you like, folks you can talk to. On the second morning, as we begin making our choices, Stern and Kemp and I have few disagreements. We huddle together at the counsel table, directing our decisions to prospective jurors, taken up in groups of four. Barbara is invited by Sandy to come up from the nearest spectator bench to join in our consultation. She places her hand lightly on my shoulder, but offers no comment. Standing close to me as we confer, dressed in a dark blue silk suit, and again a matching hat, she conveys an impression of somber dignity, of grieving well restrained. Overall, the effect is a little like the Kennedy widow's. She is playing her small part well. Last night, after the voir dire started, Sandy explained to Barbara that he would be calling on her in this fashion. At home, she expressed appreciation for Sandy's courtesy, and I explained to her that courtesy was not his prime intent. Stern again wants all the jurors to see at the outset that my wife is still on my side, and that we, in this modern age, defer to the opinions of women. The defense gets to excuse 10 jurors without explanation, so-called peremptories. The prosecution gets 6. Nico's plan seems to be pretty much the inverse of ours. Although with fewer challenges, he does not have the same opportunity to shape the panel. In general, he seems to be looking for his voters, older ethnic types, generally Roman Catholics. For that reason, without having planned to do it earlier, we strike all the Italians. I am more comfortable with the group that we end up with than was often the case when I was a prosecutor. There is a preponderance of younger people, many of them single, a female drugstore manager in her late 20s, a young woman who is an accountant with a brokerage house, a 26-year-old man is an assembly line foreman, and another fellow about his age runs restaurant services at a local hotel and fiddles part-time with computers. There is a young black woman who does auditing at a local insurance company. Among the 12, we have a divorced female schoolteacher, a secretary for a local rail line, a man who retired last year from running a high school music program, and an auto mechanic, also a Burger King management trainee, a retired nurse's aide, and a cosmetic saleswoman from Morton's. 9 whites, 3 blacks, 7 women, 5 men. Laren also seats 4 alternates, who will hear the evidence but not take part in deliberations unless one of the 12 regulars falls ill or is otherwise excused. With the jury chosen early in the second afternoon, we are ready to start my trial. At 2:10, we arrive again at the courthouse for opening statements. The atmosphere is now the same as yesterday morning. The lull of jury selection is past, and the blood urge is on the air. The adrenalized excitement of beginning becomes a kind of painful irritant that I feel seeping into my bones. Kemp calls me into the hallway outside the courtroom, and we walk some distance to get away from the gaggle of unhappy onlookers for whom the bailiffs have not been able to find seats. Out here, you can never be certain who is listening. The best journalists would not report something they overheard, but you can never tell who is talking to the prosecutors. "I want to say something," Jamie tells me. He has chopped a good 2 inches off the curled edges of his page boy, and he is turned out in a distinguished blue pinstriped suit purchased from J. Press in New Haven. He is handsome enough to have chosen Hollywood instead of law. From comments, I have come to realize that he made enough money playing his guitar to be quite comfortable without working. Instead, he is in the office, reading cases, writing memos, conferring with Stern and me until 11 and 12 o'clock at night. "I like you," Jamie says. "I like you too," I answer. "And I really hope you beat this thing. I've never told a client this before, but I think you will." There are no more than a year or two's worth of clients in Jamie's life, and so the comment is not worth that much as a prediction, but I am touched by his good feeling. I put a hand on his shoulder and I thank him. He did not tell me, of course, that I am innocent. He knows better than to be convinced of that. The evidence is against me. Probably, if you shook him awake in the middle of the night and put the question, he would tell you he does not know. Stern appears now. He is almost jaunty. His flesh is invigorated by the high excitement. The broadcloth of his shirt is so white and free of creases that it appears almost holy as it meets his full cheeks. He is about to give the opening statement in the most noted case of his career.
Suddenly, I am full of envy. I have not thought in all the months about how much fun it would be to try this case, an understandable omission. But those old inclinations suddenly surge forth amid this supercharged air. The big Night Saints case, a 23-defendant conspiracy which I tried with Raymond, had a fraction of this attention, but it was still like taking hold of a live wire, a drumming excitement that did not stop even in sleep for 7 weeks. Like motorcycling or mountain climbing. You know that you have been here. I am sad suddenly, briefly despairing over my lost trade.
So? Sandy asks me.
I told him I thought that he would win, says Kemp. Stern speaks Spanish. His eyebrows shoot up toward the hairless crest of his scalp.
Never out loud, he says. Never!
Then he takes my hand and faces me with his deepest look.
Rusty, we will do our best.
I know, I say. Coming back into the courtroom, Barbara, who has gone back and forth from the U over lunch, emerges from the crowd to hug me. It is half an embrace, one arm firmly around my waist. She kisses my cheek, then wipes away the lipstick with her hand. She talked to Nat. He wants you to know he loves you, she says.
I do too.
She says this in a cute way, so that the tone, in spite of her good intentions, is still somewhat equivocal. Nonetheless, she has done her best. It is the right time and the right place for maximum performance. The jury files in from the waiting room, where they will eventually deliberate. It is located right behind the jury box. The divorced schoolteacher actually smiles at me as she takes her seat. Laren explains the function of opening statements, a prediction of the evidence, a forecast.
It is not an argument, he says. The lawyers will not set forth the inferences which they think arise from the proof. They will simply tell you, in an unvarnished fashion, what the actual evidence will be.
Laren says this, no doubt, as a warning to delay. In a circumstantial case, a prosecutor needs some way at the outset to make a jury see how it all fits together. But Nico will have to do this carefully. However Delaguardia feels about Laren, the jury is in love with the judge already. His charm is like a floral scent he emits into the air. Nico will gain nothing from being upbraided. Laren says,
Mr. Delaguardia,
and Nico stands, trim, erect, bristling with anticipation, a person at the very top.
May it please the court, he says, the traditional beginning.
Right from the start, he is surprisingly bad. I know immediately what has happened. The time constraints and the burden of running the office have impinged severely on his preparation. He has never gone over this before. Some of it is being improvised, perhaps in response to Laren's warning right before he began. Nico cannot shake his drawn, nervous look, and he cannot find a rhythm. He keeps hesitating in spots. Even with Nico's inadequate preparation, much of this is difficult for me to hear. Nico may lack his usual style and organization, but he is still hitting the high spots. The counterpoint of the physical evidence against what I said and did not say to Horgan and Lapranzer is, as I always feared, particularly effective. On the other hand, Delay misses points of emphasis. He tells the jury too little about things he should be the one to disclose. A smart prosecutor usually seeks to diffuse defense evidence by mentioning it first, demonstrating from his own mouth that his case can stand the defense's strongest blows. But Nico does not adequately detail my background. He fails to say that I was second in command of the office. And in describing my relationship with Carolyn, he omits any mention of the McGaffin trial. When Stern gets up in his own quiet way, he will make these abbreviations appear to be concealment. In the area of my relations with Carolyn, Nico makes the only deviation from what we had predicted. Nico's problem is deeper than I, or even Stern, had understood. Delay does not simply lack proof of my relationship with Carolyn. He has not even correctly guessed what occurred. The evidence, he tells the jury, will show that Mr. Sabich and Miss Polhemus had a personal relationship that had gone on for many months, at least 7 or 8 months before the murder. Mr. Sabich was in Ms. Polhemus's apartment. She called him on the phone. He called her. It was, as I say, a personal relationship. He pauses. An intimate relationship. But all was not well in this relationship. Mr. Sabich was, apparently, very unhappy. Mr. Sabich was, it seems, intensely jealous. Laren on the bench has swung about and now is glaring. Nico is doing what the judge warned him about, arguing rather than simply describing his witnesses and exhibits. In his agitation, the judge glances now and then in Sandy's direction, a signal for Sandy to object. But Stern is quiet. Interruptions are discourteous, and Sandy is himself in court. More important, Nico is at the point in his oration where he is saying things that Stern knows he may not prove. Mr. Sabich was jealous. He was jealous because Miss Polhemus was seeing not only him. Miss Polhemus had formed a new relationship, a relationship that apparently infuriated Mr. Sabich. Another weighty caesura. A relationship with the prosecuting attorney, Raymond Horgan. This detail has never before found public life. Nico undoubtedly cabined it to protect his new alliance with Raymond. But he cannot help himself. He is still Nico, and he actually turns to the press rows as he lets this news into the world. There is an audible stirring in the courtroom, and Laren, with the mention of his former partner, finally loses his cool. "Mr. De La Guardia," he thunders, "you were warned, sir. Your remarks are not to be in the nature of a closing argument. You will confine yourself to a sterile recitation of the facts, or your opening will be over. Do I make myself clear?" Nico faces the bench. He actually looks surprised. His prominent Adam's apple bobs as he swallows. "Certainly," he says. "Jealousy," I write on my notepad, and pass it to Kemp. Given the choice between no motive and a motive he cannot quite prove, Nico has chosen the latter. It may even be the smarter gamble. But at the end, he will be working hard to stretch the facts. Stern moves to the podium as soon as Nico is through. The judge offers a recess, but Sandy smiles gently and says he is prepared to go on right now, if the court please. Sandy is unwilling to let Nico's remarks accumulate force on reflection. He steps around the podium and rests one elbow on it. He wears a brown suit, tailor-made, that conforms subtly to his full shape. His heavy face is still with portent. "How are we to answer this?" he asks. "Rusty Sabich and I. What can we say when Mr. De La Guardia tells you about 2 fingerprints, but not another? What can we say when the evidence will show you gaps and suppositions, gossip and cruel innuendo? What can we say when a distinguished public servant is put on trial on the basis of circumstantial evidence which, as you will be able to determine, does not approach that precious standard of reasonable doubt?" Reasonable doubt. He turns, he steps, he comes 2 feet closer to the jury. "The prosecution must prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt." He harks back to everything they heard over the last 2 days from Judge Little. At the outset, Stern has locked arms before the jurors with that mighty and learned jurist, a particularly effective device in light of Laren's first put-down of delay. Sandy uses the term circumstantial evidence repeatedly. He mentions the words rumors and gossip. Then he talks about me. "And who is Rusty Sabich? Not simply, as Mr. De La Guardia told you, a top deputy in the prosecuting attorney's office. The top deputy. Among a handful of the finest trial lawyers in this county, this state. The evidence will show you that.
a top graduate of the University Law School, a member of the Law Review, clerk to the Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court. He gave his career, his life, to public service, to stopping and preventing and punishing criminal behavior. Not, Stern glances contemptuously toward the prosecutors, to committing it. Listen, ladies and gentlemen, to the names of some of the persons whom the evidence will show you Rusty Savage brought to justice. Listen, because these are persons whose wrongdoing was so well known that even you who are not regularly in this courthouse will recognize these names, and I am sure will once again be grateful for Rusty Savage's work. He spends 5 minutes talking about the Night Saints and other cases, longer than he should, but DeLaGuardia is hard put to object after Sandy endured his opening without complaint. He is the son of an immigrant, a Yugoslavian freedom fighter, who was persecuted by the Nazis. His father came here in 1946 to a land of freedom, where there would be no more atrocities. What would Ivan Savage think today? I would squirm were I not under the sternest orders to show nothing. I sit with my hands folded and look ahead. At all moments I am to appear resolute. Lamentably, Stern did not give me a preview of this portion. Even if I testify, I will not testify to this. Not that the prosecutors would be likely to disprove it. Stern's manner is somehow commanding. The accent lends an intrigue to his speech, and his considered formality gives him substance. He makes no prediction of what the defense will show. He steers clear of promising my testimony. Instead, he focuses on deficiencies. No evidence, not a scintilla of direct evidence that Rusty Savage handled any murder weapon. No sign that Rusty Savage took part in any violence. And what is the cornerstone of this circumstantial case? Mr. DeLaGuardia told you many things about the relationship of Mr. Savage and Ms. Polhemus. He did not tell you, as the evidence will show, that they were co-workers, that they worked as trial lawyers, not as lovers, on a case of tremendous importance. He did not mention that. He left that for me to tell you. All right, then, I have. And the evidence will show that to you, too. You should mind closely what the evidence shows you, and does not show you, about the relationship of Rusty Savage and Carolyn Polhemus. Mind closely in this circumstantial case where Mr. DeLaGuardia seeks to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. I tell you flatly, flatly, that the evidence will not show you what Mr. DeLaGuardia has said it would. It will not. You see, this case will not involve facts, but rather supposition upon supposition, guess upon guess. Mr. Stern, says Laren mildly, you seem to be falling into the same trap as Mr. DeLaGuardia. Sandy turns. He actually bows in an abbreviated way. I am so sorry, Your Honor, he says. He seems to have inspired me. A laugh, a small one, from everyone. The judge, a number of members of the jury, a small laugh at DeLay's expense. Sandy turns back to the jury and remarks, as if he were speaking to himself, I must keep myself from getting carried away by this case. Then he plants his last seed. No commitments, just a few words. Well, one cannot help asking, why? As you listen to the evidence, ask, why? Not why Carolyn Polhemus was murdered. That, regrettably, is something no one will be learning from this proof. But why Rusty Savage sits here falsely accused? Why offer a circumstantial case, a case that is supposed to show guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and does not? Sandy stops. He tilts his head. Perhaps he knows the answer, perhaps he does not. He speaks softly. Why? Is the last thing that he says. Chapter 27. They cannot find the glass. Nico admits this as soon as Stern and Kemp and I arrive on the third morning of trial. The first witnesses will be called today.
How in the world? Asks Stern.
I apologize, says Nico. Tommy tells me he forgot about it at first. He really did. Now they're looking high and low. It'll turn up. But I have a problem.
De La Guardia and Stern stroll away, conferring. Molto watches them with obvious concern. He seems reluctant to leave his place at the prosecution table like a whipped dog. Really, Tommy does not look well. It is too early in the trial to be as exhausted as he appears. He has a yellow cast to his skin, and his suit, the same as yesterday's, does not seem to have had any time to rest. I would not be surprised if Molto never made it home last night.
How can they lose a piece of evidence like that? Kemp asks me.
Happens all the time, I answer. The Police Evidence Center, over in McGrath Hall, has more unclaimed items than a pawn shop. Tags get knocked off. Numbers are reversed. I started many cases with evidence misplaced. Unfortunately, Nico is right. The glass will turn up. Stern and De La Guardia have agreed to advise the judge of this development before he takes the bench. We will all go back to chambers. This will save Nico from a public whipping. Stern's concession on points like this, minor courtesies, is a kind of thing that has made him popular around the PA's office. Other lawyers would demand to be on the record so that Nico could take a hiding before the press. We all wait a moment in the judge's outer office while his secretary, Corrine, keeps an eye on the phone light to see when the judge completes the call he is presently taking. Corrine is stately and large-chested, and the courthouse wags regularly speculated on the nature of her relationship with Laren, until last fall, when she married a probation officer named Perkins. Laren has always been a ladies' man of some renown. He divorced about 10 years ago, and over time I've heard a lot of tales about him drinking Jack Daniels in the pretty people night spots down on Bayou Boulevard, that pickup strip which certain sages refer to as the Street of Dreams. He says, "Come right in," Corrine tells us, putting down the phone after a brief conversation with the judge to announce our group. Kemp and Nico and Molto precede us. Stern wants a moment with me to confer. When we enter, Nico has already begun telling the judge the problem. He and Kemp are in armchairs before the judge's desk. Molto sits a distance away on the sofa. The chambers, the judge's inner sanctum, has a distinguished bearing. One wall is solid with gold-toned spines of state law reports, and Laren also has his own wall of respect. There is a large picture of the judge and Raymond, among a number of photos of the judge with politicians, mostly black. "Your Honor," Nico is saying, "I learned the first time last night from Tommy." "Well, I thought Tommy indicated yesterday that you had the glass, and he simply had overlooked this matter. Tommy, I'll tell you something right now." The judge is on his feet behind his desk, looking rather legal in a purple-toned shirt with white collar and cuffs. He has been roaming in his books and papers as he listens, but now he turns about and points a stout finger at Molto. "If I have the same kind of bullshit from you in this case I've had in the past, I'll throw you in the lockup. I really will. Don't you be telling me one thing and meaning something else. And I want to say this right in front of the prosecuting attorney. Nico, you know we've always gotten along, but there's a history here." The judge tips his large head in Molto's direction.
"Judge, I understand. I really do. That's why I was concerned as soon as I learned of the problem. I really do believe that it's oversight."
Laren glances balefully at De La Guardia from the corner of his eye. Nico does not even flinch. He's doing a pretty good job. He has both hands in his lap and is making his best effort to appear the suppliant. This is not an attitude that comes to him naturally, and his readiness to humble himself before the judge is actually quite winning. There must have been hell to pay last night between Molto and him. That's why Tommy looks so bad. Laren, however, is not about to let the subject go. As usual, he has caught all the implications quickly. For better than a month, the prosecutors have been promising to produce a glass they knew they could not find.
"Isn't this something?" the judge asks.
He looks for support to Stern.
"You know, Nico, I don't issue these orders just for the hell of it. You do with your evidence as you like, but really, who had this glass last?
There's some disagreement, Judge, but we believe it was the police.
Naturally, says Laren. He looks off toward the distance in disgust.
Well, you see what we have here. You have defied an order of the court. The defense has not had an opportunity to prepare. And you have given an opening statement, Nico, in which you must have referred to this evidence half a dozen times. Well, that's your problem now. When you find the glass, assuming you find it, then we'll determine whether or not it comes into evidence. Let's go try this case.
Nico's difficulties, however, are more complex than one angry judge. The state case has been prepared with the witnesses expected in an established sequence, referred to as an order of proof. The first person to testify is supposed to describe the crime scene, and accordingly, he will mention the glass.
Not in my courtroom, says Laren. No, sir. We're not going to be talking any more about evidence that nobody can find.
Stern finally speaks up. He announces that we have no objection to delay proceeding as he had planned. Your Honor, if the prosecution fails to find the glass, we will object to any further evidence regarding it. He means, of course, the fingerprints. But for the time being, there is no purpose to delay, if Your Honor will permit it.
Laren shrugs. It's Sandy's lawsuit. This is the subject Sandy and I discussed in the judge's outer office.
If we object, we can make Nico take witnesses out of the order he had planned. But Sandy thinks the advantage is greater if Nico's first witness has to explain that a piece of evidence is missing. Better that they look like Keystone Cops, was how Stern put it. The disorganization will make a poor impression on the jury. Besides, there is little damage to me in the bare fact that a glass was found, and as I pointed out to Kemp, the police evidence custodians will eventually locate the glass. They always do.
I would think you would give Mr. Stern an order of proof, so that he has notice of when you're coming to this area again.
Molto speaks up.
We have one, Judge. We'll give it to them right now.
Tommy fiddles in the sloppy heap of papers on his lap, and eventually passes a sheet to Kemp.
And let's put this on the record,
Laren says. Nico's punishment. He must explain this screw-up in public after all. While the lawyers are before the bench repeating our chamber's conference in the presence of the court reporter, I examine the order of proof. I am eager to know when LaPranzer will be testifying. The sooner he does, the sooner the search for Leon can resume. I have tried to get Sandy's PI to look further, but he claims there is nothing to do. The list, however, provides no good news. Lip is scheduled toward the latter part of the case. Leon and I will have to wait. Even in my disappointment, I recognize that Tommy and Nico have constructed their case with care. They will begin with the murder scene and the collection of the physical evidence, and will then start a slowly accelerating demonstration of why I am the murderer. First will come their proof, equivocal as it is, of my relationship with Carolyn. Then my questionable handling of the investigation. Near the end, they will offer the various bits of evidence that put me at the murder scene. The fingerprints, the fibers, the phone records, the nearing maid, the blood test results. Painless Kumagai will testify last, and, I suppose, offer an expert opinion on how it was done. Up on the bench, Laren is still chewing Nico out, for the record. And the prosecutors will immediately advise the defense when the evidence is located. Is that correct? Nico promises. With that matter settled, the jury is brought in, and Nico announces the name of the prosecution's first witness, Detective Harold Greer. He enters from the corridor and stands before Laren to be sworn. As soon as Greer is up there, it is obvious to all of us why Nico wanted to maintain the predetermined order of proof. Juries, for obvious reasons, tend to remember the first witness, and Greer is impressive, a huge, well-spoken black man, calm and orderly in his presentation of himself. With or without the glass, he is the image of competence. The department is full of officers like Greer, men and women with the IQs of college professors who became cops because it was, within their horizons, the best thing available. Molto is doing the questioning. He looks rumpled, but his direct examination is well prepared.
And where was the body?
Greer was the third officer on the scene. Carolyn was discovered about 9:30 a.m. She missed an 8 o'clock meeting and a 9 o'clock court call. Her secretary called the super directly. All he did, he told me months ago, was push the door open and look around. He could see then he needed the cops. The beat guys called for Greer. Greer describes what he observed and the way the evidence techs did their work under his direction. Greer identifies a sealed plastic packet that contains the fibers that were lifted from Carolyn's body and a larger packet that contains her skirt, from which more of the Zorak 5 fibers were obtained. Molto and he smooth over the glass. Greer describes finding it on the bar, watching the evidence techs seal the baggie.
And where is the glass at present?
We've had a little trouble locating it. It should turn up in the police evidence room. Next, Molto raises the specter of the removed diaphragm. Greer says that in a thorough search of the apartment, he found no contraceptive device. Then, with all the little bits of evidence which the police discovered inventoried before the jury, Molto moves to his climax.
Based on your experience in 9 years as a homicide detective and the appearance of the scene, did you have any opinion as to what had taken place? Molto asks.
Stern makes his first objection before the jury. Your Honor, Stern scolds, this is speculative. This cannot be regarded as an expert opinion. Mr. Molto is asking about a hunch. Laren strokes his cheeks with his big hand, but shakes his head.
Overruled?
Molto repeats the question. Based on the position of the body, Greer responds, the way it was tied, the signs of disturbance, the open window over the fire escape, on first looking at the scene, I was of the opinion that Ms. Polhemus had been murdered in the course of, or as the result of, a sexual assault.
A rape?
Asks Molto, a leading question, not usually permitted on direct examination, but harmless under the circumstances.
Yes, says Greer.
And were police photographers at the scene?
They were.
What, if anything, did they do?
I asked them to take a number of photos of the scene, and they did that.
In your presence?
From the evidence cart the prosecutors wheeled into court this morning, Molto takes the collection of photos I looked at 4 months ago in my office. He shows each to Sandy before he presents them to Greer. Molto has set his examination up cleverly. Usually, a judge will limit the prosecution's use of photos in a murder case. It is grisly and prejudicial. But by emphasizing the appearances, which the prosecution, of course, will argue were staged, Tommy has deprived us of the usual grounds for objections. We sit, attempting to appear implacable, while Greer describes each of the gruesome photos and identifies them as having accurately reflected the scene. When Molto offers them, Sandy approaches the bench and asks the judge to look them over himself.
We can do with just two of the body, Laren says.
He removes another two, but he allows Molto to pass the ones admitted among the jurors at the end of Greer's examination. I do not dare to look up often, but I can sense from the stillness in the box that the blood and Carolyn's contorted corpse have had the effect the prosecutors hoped. The schoolteacher will not be smiling at me again for quite a while.
Cross-examination, says the judge.
Just a few matters, says Sandy.
He smiles a bit at Greer. We will not be challenging this witness.
You mentioned a glass detective. Where is that?
Stern starts to look among the exhibits Greer identified. It's not here.
I am sorry. I thought you testified about it.
I did.
Oh. Sandy appears flustered. But you do not have it?
No, sir.
When was the last time you saw it?
At the scene.
You have not seen it since?
No, sir.
Have you tried to find it?
Greer smiles, probably the first time since he took the stand.
Yes, sir. I see from your expression you have put some effort into this.
Yes, sir.
And the glass still cannot be found?
No, sir.
And who would have handled it last?
I don't know,
Mr. Molto over there has got the evidence receipts.
Oh.
Sandy turns in Tommy's direction. Molto appears faintly amused. It is Sandy's play-acting that he finds humorous. But the jury, of course, does not realize that is the source of this slight grin. To them, Tommy must appear somewhat arrogant.
Mr. Molto has them?
Yes, sir.
Ordinarily, we would have the evidence, too?
Yes, sir. The prosecutor gets the evidence and the original tags.
So Mr. Molto has the tag, but not the glass?
That's right. Sandy turns again to Molto. While looking at him, Stern says,
Thank you, detective.
He appears to ruminate before he again faces the witness. Stern spends a few minutes on the details of the collection of various pieces of evidence. When he reaches the diaphragm, he pauses with some apparent emphasis.
A contraceptive device was not the only item you failed to find. Is that right, detective?
Greer's face narrows. He did not find the Hope Diamond or Aunt Tilly's missing lace hanky. The question can't be answered.
Well, detective, you and the officers under your command made a very thorough search of the apartment, did you not?
We certainly did.
And yet, sir, you failed to find not merely a diaphragm, but also any cream or jelly or other substance that could be expected to be utilized with it. Is that not correct?
Greer hesitates. He had not thought of this before. That's correct, he says at last. Nico turns immediately to Tommy. They are seated 15 feet in front of me, facing the jury. I've never had the chance before to watch my opponents.